Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invite you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. Seeking refuge with Allah from the shaitan, the rejected enemy of mankind. With Allah's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. Openly declaring Allah is the one God and there are no partners with Allah. And Prophet Muhammad, prayers and peace be upon him, is a servant and messenger of Allah. Greetings of peace to everyone. Peace. Believing in doing good and being a doer of good. Peace. Humanity for humanity. For the sake of humanity. Peace is the ultimate goal that we as human beings need to have in our life. And peace is what we are all striving for. Even when we barbarically do so, we are seeking peace. Welcome to CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, wherein the host is Attorney Edward Ahmed Mitchell. the National Director. You may have a chapter of CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, in your area, in your state, and you may probably encounter the use of their assistance. However the case, Council on American Islamic Relations is exactly what it's saying, American, Islamic, America, and al-Islam, the relationship. Historians, you can study or research Thomas Jefferson and the Quran and the senator who used the Quran, Mr. Ellis, Senator Ellis, as a swearing in for being a senator. Where are we now in relations, America? Where is America now in relations to the Islamic Council that is really truly looking deep into the fabric of the people that make up America and looking at the rights of the human being and how those rights are unjustly or how the injustices are targeting those rights. Whoever the person or group that targets the rights of human beings, Council on American Islamic Relations is open to hear from you and to see how they can best achieve the goal of making sure that your rights are not targeted. Now, we go to what is on everyone's mind, the Gaza area, the ceasefire request. What we're going to share with you is first a presentation that Dearborn, Michigan has been targeted as the capital of jihad. Words make people. Words influence people. And some persons have heard those words and have put them in print. And because they've put them in print, now the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Dearborn mayor, Mr. Daoud Abdullah, they're responding to those charges. Walid and we're going to share that with you as I don't the Muslim. It's Muslim mayor as well. So why don't I let you hear it, and I apologize. The first thing we do is share incorrect information. All right. Here, you're going to hear this now.
A Wall Street Journal article has Dearborn police on high alert. The article calls Dearborn America's jihad capital, and that has led Dearborn's mayor to up police presence at places of worship this evening. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Pamela Osborne.
And I'm Will Jones. Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamoud is calling the article garbage. He said it has led to a rise in Islamophobic posts online targeting the city. Jacqueline Francis is following this story for us tonight. Jacqueline.
Will and Pam, the mayor and other community members, they are not having this, expressing outrage over the op-ed titled, Welcome to Dearborn, America's Jihad Capital. It's the inflammatory article getting a heated reaction from the city of Dearborn.
This is a theory of far-right discourse that has smeared the Muslim community in Dearborn.
The title, Welcome to Dearborn, America's Jihad Capital, written by Stephen Stolinsky, LGBTQ rights, the imams and politicians in Dearborn side with Hamas against Israel and Iran against the U.S. The executive director of Michigan's chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations calling the article filth.
People in the city aren't having pro-militant or pro-extremist rallies. They are simply calling for a ceasefire in regards to people in our area who had family members killed.
Dearborn's mayor also reacting, ramping up police presence across all places of worship and major infrastructure points, posting on social media, quote, "This is a direct result of the garbage Wall Street Journal opinion piece that has led to an alarming increase in bigoted and Islamophobic rhetoric online targeting the city of Dearborn. Stay vigilant." In addition to amping up police presence at places of worship here in the city, police are also closely monitoring social media for threats. Reporting live in Dearborn, Dr. Francis, Global 4.
As a small business owner, time management is key, so today I'm using Adobe Express to come up with a new fall banner. There is an unbelievable amount of templates, and it's super easy to customize them to fit your personality and vision. Like, seriously, how could I not fall in love with these tools? Okay, no more fall puns. Next, I'm going to add some generative AI powered by Adobe Firefly to add some extra razzle-dazzle. I can use text-to-image to generate anything I can think of. This took me no time at all to make, and it's perfect. All that's left is to upload to my shop.
Small business owners who want to save time and money on professional liability insurance should go to buyburk.com to get a policy in less than 5 minutes. As part of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Insurance Group, we make it simple to save up to 20%. Get a quote and buy your policy online, or speak with our licensed insurance experts for help in choosing the right coverage. Visit buyburk.com today.
At the same time, I'm sort of pushed on that notion when I hear people or know that people exist who don't really seem to sound in a particular way.
I'm told all the time when somebody answers the phone, oh, I thought you were a white boy. What was that supposed to mean? I'm speaking the English. I'm speaking the way that my family spoke. But did I know the language? Do I know another language? Yeah, I know another language.
It's just like anything else. It's surely as a kid learns how to use words, they learn how to use them in the ways that they're being used.
What is it you know when you know African-American English, when you know it as a system, when you use it as your native language? Speakers of African-American English, from my particular viewpoint, are those speakers who grow up in African-American English-speaking communities.
Many people assume that black English is one thing, all black people speak it pretty much the same way. There are many, many types of black English here in the United States.
Certainly there are differences that are regional differences, but I think there's some core aspects, and I think that's shared by many, many, many speakers of African-American English. But as a speaker who grew up in Southwest Louisiana, I do things with African-American English that I might not expect my counterpart who grew up in some other area to do.
I walk up to him, I say, what's up? I'm speaking. I'm saying, hey, how you doing? I ran into some guys from New York up there in the middle of here, and we're in a big Burger King, get something to eat. I'm standing in line. They stand beside me. I'm like, what's up? And he just turned to me like, what's up? You know, to them, what's up means, I'm like, no, I'm speaking. I'm from Mississippi.
I'm in between Cali, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, Philly, New York. You'll get a different greeting. That's just the start. I can go down to Atlanta and say, you know, what it do? Detroit, what up, though? New York, what's up, sir? Cali, what up, blood? You have to be careful where you at. Say blood, though. But they know. You say, what's up, blood? It's family.
Well, I'm from a place where we don't use the dialect that I use here, but I'm able to maneuver with it. So you might hear, what up, shorty? What up, though? You know, and I'll just give them something that I have from Detroit. It'll be like, what up, shorty? I'll be like, what up, though? Or if you go to New Orleans, say, hey, Wody. The language gives you access, and it'll give you a barrier. So the best thing to do is use it for your access.
I am from an African-American background, but I went to a predominantly white school. And even when I was younger, my black family members would make fun of me and call me white girl. White girl, you talk like a white girl, you talk like a white girl, because they lived in a more urban area and I lived in the suburbs. So all my life has kind of been this, I talk like this with this group of people, and then I talk like this with this group of people.
I think a lot of people are surprised at how much individual speakers can actually shift. I use sort of mainstream ways of talking so much in my professional life that a lot of people doubt that I actually speak any other way. But when I'm outside that professional setting, it really is sort of my language of comfort, my language of home, it's my language of family, it's my language of friendship. I think you can look at middle-class speakers and assume that they don't speak African-American vernacular English because all I'm hearing is standard English. But what happens is that a lot of middle-class speakers do what I like to call code-switching. I consider myself to be a code-switcher, but I don't spend a lot of time thinking, now I will use the vernacular. So this is a girlfriend that I'm talking to.
Because let me tell you, that daycare tuition ain't no joke. It ain't no joke. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I only got a few more months, girl, and we'll be out. A few more months. This is it for us, girl.
And so the last one is me with my mom.
Where you from?
I was like, Columbia.
What part of Columbia you don't know about Hague? Like, the suburbs. And he thought that was just so funny. But I'm like, I don't know nothing about no dog on Hague.
With any kind of code switching, I think it happens below the level of conscious awareness.
When I'm talking to my sisters, it's very casual and very comfortable. But when I'm talking to, you know, other people, or when I'm talking to professors, it's like, for them, it's like I'm a different person. And it makes you self-conscious, and it makes you feel, for me, as though I was not necessarily being true to myself, or being black, but then you come to find that it's okay to kind of meet people where they are.
It's so interesting, this issue of identity, language, acceptance, and inclusion or exclusion. I want to be included, so I will use a certain type of language. Who wants to be excluded?
You have this kind of complex push in which, on the one hand, the language is vibrant, it's fulfilling, it's expressive, it's enjoyable, and on the other hand, you have African-Americans dealing with the larger society, getting pushback, getting misunderstanding.
Unless you have your own company or you're a rapper or you're an athlete with vernacular, you are going to be pushed out of opportunities and marginalized for survival, economic survival. I'm going to have to do that song and dance.
African-American English has a place, but for the most part, it's always relegated to entertainment. In rap music, R&B, things like that, but it's not okay outside of those realms.
The game only changes if you can commodify certain aspects of culture in disadvantaged communities. But the game doesn't really change when it comes to the different things that we see as professional and managerial. They're changing in the sense that they're allowing more of us in who were historically excluded. But in order to be, we have to read the cultural code of that space. I enjoy the nuances of how they speak and how I speak, and I'm not changing me, but I'm also grown. I do tell them, and I'm very transparent and honest about the fact that you live in a world where you do need to translate, and you do need to code switch, and you do need to speak King's English, and you do need to make sure that you're able to navigate the system, right? Because there is privilege, and that does exist.
It was always very contentious about what we should do with student language. They need to have standard English in order to be successful in school the way it's set up right now. But there was a lot of times a real negative, people talked about student language in a really negative way. That came not just from white teachers, but that came from African-American teachers. It came from parents. It came from societal messages.
Me telling you what you just said is said incorrectly is like telling you that your mama is not smart. So what I just said, my mom said to me, that's where I got it from, or my dad, or my people, or whatever. If I said, that's not how smart people talk, because that's what teachers say, right? That's not the correct way to say that. See, what you're not saying is that everybody in my life doesn't speak correctly. Right? What you're not saying is that everybody other than you, right, is wrong, which can't be right.
People have the impression that African-American English is nothing more than a collection of errors because that's how they've been socialized. If it's not standard English, it's wrong. So we have this framework that all of us have been indoctrinated into. There's a right and a wrong in language. Language itself is always right because there's always a systematicity, a patterning to it.
All stigmatized languages usually have this false reputation of having no structure or having no grammar.
What does standard English accomplish that these so-called versions of substandard English don't accomplish in terms of communication? Nothing. You know what I mean? Nothing at all. Anything that seems to stand in the way, you say, oh, it'll help you get a job. Well, is that because of the language? It's not that you're unable to communicate, or is that because of all these various isms that stand in the way of you being able to take care of yourself?
That's the one thing that people don't understand the most. This is not random. People are not making mistakes. People are not confused about a rule. They are governed by a different set of rules.
In African-American language, you can say things like, he happy, or John Tall, or he da man. You might say, well, okay, folks are just leaving out his or her. But they're not just leaving it out. In language, nothing is ever just like random. You can just leave it out or put it in. No, there's a very, very strict set of rules. Like, There's some places where you can't leave it alone.
You will hear speakers say quite often, you know, he nice, he running. But you wouldn't hear those speakers say, I nice, I running. And you can see these patterns emerging as children are developing African-American English. So people don't wake up at 15 and just start speaking African-American English. This is a system that's really in place early on, and children are working it out as they become older.
Let me give you a different example that people talk about a lot. You can say, you know, John be studying Saturday night. Okay? Now, a lot of people think that that B is just like is in English. I could look at somebody sitting in front of me, and I could say, you know, John's sitting down right now. But I can't say, John, be sitting down right now. B always means that something happens habitually, frequently, and so on.
You saw a bunch of people in New York that we know, and the way they be talking and stuff.
You acquire it as part of the normal human facility of acquiring a language.
A lot of times people assume that there is some linguistic basis for, you know, the stigma against the variety. And they're not aware that it really is about the people.
The issue, Mr. Chairman, has received a lot of attention all over the United States. And I simply want to say that I think aphonics is absurd.
In the mid-90s, 1995, 1996, there was a big phonics controversy. The Oakland School Board was trying to get what had been fairly solidly established linguistic research into schools.
Many linguists have stated that Oakland's decision is credible, it is rational, and a potentially effective way to improve the academic standards of its students.
And the public really misunderstood the message of what was happening and reacted in ways that kind of set back what educators were trying to do with language.
That's just bad English, isn't it? How could you say that's a language?
No, that's different English.
That's
it's
not bad English.
But that's your opinion that it's bad.
A lot of teachers just kind of take what they've heard, sort of the predominant social narrative, and they just sort of reproduce them. When we start being more critical of those and teachers start thinking about it more closely, then we've got a lot more opportunities to help kids.
I'm really actually quite tickled when I move into classroom spaces and I see how facile kids are with language, even if they're not, you know, adept as we measure it on a test with standard English. But they are so adroit at moving back and forth and talking to one another and volleying. And we don't know how to, like, that kind of skill into the test that we're using to evaluate them that then has some serious consequences for their mobility in American society.
Because language and identity are so closely tied, if we value more language, then we also value more student ways of being within school.
This person says he be going to work.
The average citizen who encountered the term of Ebonics during did so at a time when late-night talk show hosts were, you know, lampooning the term. And as a professional linguist, I was disheartened when I saw so many people mocking a term that referred to linguistic circumstances that I think should be better understood by the entire nation, but which have been the object of linguistic discrimination since the inception of slavery. Slave descendants have a unique linguistic heritage in comparison to every other immigrant group that came to this country. After captured, were often isolated linguistically from others that spoke their own mother tongue while they were on the west coast of Africa. That linguistic isolation was also maintained on the ships during the Atlantic crossing. And as a result of that, not one indigenous African language has survived the Atlantic crossing intact. Once they got here, it was illegal to teach them to read and write. For hundreds of years, slaves were denied access to education. As a result of that, many of the linguistic stereotypes, many of the negative linguistic stereotypes that people embrace regarding African-American English, dismissing it as
you know, the language of someone who's being lazy or not attending to language doesn't fully appreciate the linguistic isolation that slave descendants experienced is unlike any other immigrant group in this country.
When they were brought here, African Americans were segregated into plantations. That's what happened in the Caribbean also. And what they did was to invent new languages, new varieties, taking linguistic properties from the surrounding varieties and creating new forms. These are creations of people put in an absolutely horrible set of circumstances, and out of that milieu came new language forms.
We're standing on an island where we know 40% of all people of color that were taken and survived the Middle Passage that arrived North America, first step foot on North American soil, right here on this island, Sullivan's Island. Any vessel coming into the New World, coming into the Port of Charleston, were required to quarantine their cargo, African cargo, human cargo, here on this island for approximately 10 days. Then they would be taken into Charleston and to be sold by the African slave trade, and then now their labor, their talents, their gifts, and their skills would now be diffused across the low country of South Carolina, Georgia, North and Florida as well.
She was nice. She said, Lord, I'm sorry. And so she's coming, needing the time. She has to come and get them kids. Them kids won't go in them. She'll be up. And it's just time, so she's up. Then she knows how she go home. She's right here.
Gullah is an African-American language variety spoken along the coast of South Carolina and Georgia. Gullah is a Creole variety, linguist use that term to refer to languages that emerge in situations of contact between speakers who have no common language among them.
Whether you know it or not, you're delicate folks, because it's the blending of all of those cultures that keep
at your neighbor, say, cousin. Oh, cousin. This is a family reunion. A family reunion.
The rhythm of it is very much like Caribbean English Creole. And so a lot of times, my husband, for example, is from Jamaica and now living in South Carolina, and we'll often hear a Gullah Geechee speaker and assume that they're from Jamaica or from the Caribbean.
People don't understand, but Jamaicans are the same. They're from Africa also. But it's just that they went to the Caribbean side of the area when we came for this, you know, this side of the border, so we still speak the same kind of language, but we just have a different dialect.
African Americans are trying to say, who am I? Who am I? And so they're always looking back, right? They're looking to Africa. So I say, before you get to Africa, you got to get to the Caribbean.
And there you have it, everyone. We wanted you to hear that part as well, as part of the life that is being lived in the United States. And regardless of where we are living, the responsibility for humanity to shine through, however we describe it. Now we're going to go directly to the ceasefire discussion. One moment. And this is at particular congressional gathering. Here we go.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today.
This is with Blinken and Austin to testify to aid to Israel and Ukraine.
And allow the people here and the American people to hear from their witnesses. Senator Blinken.
Thank you, Chair. 2.5 years ago, our adversaries assessed that the United States was becoming permanently divided at home, alienated from our allies and partners around the world. Working together, we demonstrated that America's resilience, its strength, leadership in the world remain unmatched. We've made historic investments in the source of America's strength at home, our democracy, our infrastructure, our economic and technological competitiveness. We've invested in the modernization of our military, and we've invested in our greatest strategic asset abroad, our network of allies and partners, which is growing larger, stronger, more united, and more capable than ever. We're standing up for our interests and values, not shrinking back. Not in the face of Russia's aggression against Ukraine, not in the face of intensifying strategic competition in the Indo-Pacific and around the world. Divided or too distracted at home to stay the course. That's what's at stake with President Biden's national security supplemental funding request. The President's request would secure the urgent resources that we need to continue to lead. Secretary Austin and I believe it's important for us to be here together today because in this mission, as in so much that we do to advance America's national security, our defense, our diplomacy, our development must work hand in hand.
Committee will suspend. And again, I appreciate that people feel passionately about these issues. I would ask that you respect our witnesses and our committee members and allow the American people to hear their testimony. We will pause until the room is cleared.
Thank you. right. So we're supposed to be watching a hearing of the Senate Appropriations Committee. The Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State will be speaking. Secretary of State has started his opening remarks, but as you can see, there have been several protesters in the audience section there that have been interrupting him before he can get through his opening statement. The purpose of this hearing is to discuss the billions of dollars the Biden administration has asked for to cover a number of different international interests and concerns, but the two big ones, of course, the Israeli war with Hamas and Ukraine's war with Russia. And it looks like the Secretary of State is going to resume his opening remarks. Let's get back in.
Amanda, we all appreciate it. Secretary of State. Thank you.
So to continue, since Russia launched its war, the robust funding provided by Congress has enabled the people of Ukraine in their courageous fight to defend their nation. It's helped make sure that Russia's invasion is a strategic debacle, making it weaker in nearly every way. And it's rallied the world in defense of Ukraine and of the principles at the heart of the United Nations Charter. Sovereignty, territorial independence, integrity, and independence. Our partners are making significant contributions to share the burden of assistance. Turning our backs on their efforts would have lasting implications for our own security and our own standing in the world. The conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East have clear links, as both the chair and vice chair have noted. Since we cut off Russia's traditional means of supplying its military, it's turned more and more to Iran for assistance. In return, Moscow has supplied Iran with increasingly advanced military technology, which poses a threat to Israel's security. Allowing Russia to prevail, with Iran's support, will simply embolden both Moscow and Iran. Second, this funding will enable us to tackle grave humanitarian needs created by autocrats and terrorists, as well as by conflict and natural disasters in Ukraine, in Gaza, in Sudan, in Armenia, and other places around the world. Food, water, medicine, other essential humanitarian assistance for civilians must be able to flow into Gaza. Civilians must be able to stay out of harm's way, a task that's made even more difficult as Hamas uses civilians as human shields, and humanitarian pauses must be considered. Helping prevent a worsening humanitarian catastrophe aligns with our nation's most deeply held principles, including our belief that every civilian life is equally valuable, equally worthy of protection. Without swift and sustained humanitarian relief, the conflict is much more likely to spread. Suffering will grow, and Hamas and its sponsors will benefit by fashioning themselves as the saviors of the very desperation that they created. Humanitarian assistance is also vital to Israel's security. Providing immediate aid and protection for Palestinian civilians in this conflict is a necessary foundation for finding partners in Gaza who have a different vision for the future than Hamas and who are willing to help make it real. Third, this funding is critical to outcompeting our strategic rivals. This request will bolster deterrence. It will support our allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific to address threats from an increasingly assertive DRC and to meet emerging challenges. It will uphold our commitment to our allies, including under our trilateral security partnership with Australia and the United Kingdom, AUKUS. And it will help countries transition to military and defense equipment that's made in America. The President's requests also include resources for the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to provide alternatives to China's coercive financing for our partners in the developing world. It will also help ease the impact of spillovers of Russia's war on food and energy security to the world's most vulnerable. The proposed $2 billion appropriation and requested authorization would generate almost $50 billion in additional development funding capacity for the World Bank and the IMF, an enormous return on our investment, demonstrating U.S. leadership in meeting urgent global challenges. Fourth and finally, the supplemental will make critical investments to protect the security of Americans here at home. That includes addressing the hemispheric challenge of irregular migration, strengthening our defense industrial base to ensure our military continues to be ready, capable, and the best equipped fighting force in the world, and that we remain the arsenal for democracy. More than $50 billion of security systems funding will replenish U.S. military stocks, strengthen our defense industrial base, and will be spent through American businesses. Each of these investments work together to achieve our mission, a stronger, safer, brighter future where America can lead from a position of strength. Let us come together and demonstrate to one another and to the world that we can rise at this moment. I also hear very much passions expressed in this room determined to see it end. But all of us know the imperative of standing up with our allies and partners when their security, when their democracies are threatened. That's what's happening now. We stand resolutely with them, even as we stand resolutely for the protection of innocent civilians. Before I close, I'd just like to thank senators for their vote today to send the president's ambassadorial nominee, Jack Lew, to Israel at this critical time. And I encourage the Senate to do the same for the 26 other nominees waiting for their vote. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
There you have it, dear listeners. Whatever your thoughts are and whatever condition is being faced by others, we know that first, utmost, Almighty God is the one God. And I gather now that the question should be, or perhaps can be, is along with this first question, what does being human mean to you? And the second question, do you have your animal self under control? Are you disciplined enough that you are able to discipline your animal self? And as we go into the discussion on tomorrow at the CWSC Friday Roundtable, we pray to have guests on tomorrow morning, perhaps Imam Wali Ayub Bilal, and along with, inshallah, Imam Abdul Rahman Kareem, and the, if not this week, it will be the following week. And then following that will be Imam Dr. Rashad Ali of New Medina, Mississippi, in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, or Summerall, Mississippi, along with Imam Alvin Sharif. But as we have the guests coming to the table, you are also invited to be at the table. This is a family, the human family planning. And in order to have solutions and then to have implementation, we have, as we are living day in and day out, implementing actions in our lives, whether we're working to save funds for whatever goals we have set as a family, individual family, we live in a United States of America. And this is where Amarahum Shura Bainahum is necessary. So what does being human mean to you? Do you have your animal self under control? Are you able to discipline your animal behavior? And then we will go into discussions about the how, actually identifying the animal behavior and who actually disciplines it. Who is it that disciplines the animal behavior? And then how do we discipline it? And then last but not least, peace, believing in doing good, and being a doer of good. Peace, believing in doing good, and being a believer, and being a doer of good. Those are going to be our questions that we pose to us as part of the human family. And as we look around our communities, there are avenues of information sharing and they're avenues of showing our commitment to excellence. And that excellence means right where we live, let's become more groomed. And if we're already appearance-wise, physical location-wise, groomed, that means we have beautiful plants, we have clean roadways, we have painted buildings, we have well-manicured or well-maintained buildings, and that we're able to speak to one another, and we're able to express our concern and our love for humanity through our love for the Almighty. So when do we begin? We've already begun. As far as CWSC, the Community-Wide Share Conference, we began 2021, January 2nd, 2021, with discussions. And here we are, just leaving out of January 2024. And now the roller begins, rolling it out. The pattern that we have to live by, we can't assume that everyone is aware. And we don't want to be at any time outside of the character of Prophet Muhammad, prayers and peace be upon him. No condescending words, but action, actions of compassion, actions of love, actions of discipline. Praise be to Almighty God. Not rudeness, not power steering, not arrogance. And there's so many more knots, because those knots are identifiable with the shaitan, the enemy of all of mankind. Thank you for being here on Care on Air, the Muslim Action Hour, the Muslim Action Hour. Thank you, dear listeners. And please join us tonight at 8 p.m. with Not Just Talk. Not Just Talk is hosted by Michael Hameen. And as this may be a night where he brings in a guest, or it may be that we are the guests, the audience. However it is, let's join Not Just Talk again at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Assalamu alaikum.